Welcome to The Health Edge, translating the science of self-care. I am Mark Pettis, and with my friend, buddy, John Bagnullo. John, good morning.
Good morning, Mark. It's great to see you, bud.
Great to see you on this beautiful late August morning. And I was just reading, John, that they're looking at eliminating daylight savings time.
Yeah.
And which it seems like every year there's some talk about this. And
yeah,
of course, it's hard to imagine Congress coming together for anything these days. But this could be the one thing that
this could be the one nonpartisan
everyone
cause,
agrees
right?
on. So I've been listening to some of the pros and cons. Nobody usually addresses the short term mortality risk when we change the clocks like that, even short term circadian shifts.
Right.
With a clock change, there's pretty good documentation that in those fall months, spring months, you know, these clock changes are not just matters of energy, convenience, whatever the original context was. So it's looking like there's momentum to finally get it done. And
that would be great.
I guess that means our mornings will be a little bit darker, but that's all right. Sun to be up a little later in the day is a plus.
I'd be all for it. I mean, for a few reasons. As a parent of young kids, it's, boy, you got like 3 or 4 week adjustment period there. That's really difficult. And then the last thing, you know, that anybody in today's modern world needs is more circadian disruption. So
yeah,
I'm all for it. I think I think we should have got rid of it 20 years ago when we started to have some data. And everything's automated now in the field. So originally it was developed for farmers so they'd have light out in the field in the morning, but everything's automated now, right? The combine has headlights, so they just go through and
they
harvest regardless of daylight.
Completely different context now. So anyhow, it'll be interesting to see if this fall they finally address that. But that has nothing to do with our topic today, which is a paper that was recently published that we'll be looking at, John. And it's a paper looking at the importance of zinc. And frequently we'll address a mineral, sort of a critical mineral or micronutrient that has a much higher prevalence of insufficiency in the general population that doesn't get a lot of attention. And this paper looked at the importance of zinc in people with both diabetes and pre-diabetes. And some of the findings that they demonstrated are really noteworthy. And so this will be a great paper to review, John. We'll look a little bit at the importance of zinc, why it is so important. We'll touch on some of the food sources that are higher in zinc and how the alignment of recommendations, dietary recommendations haven't historically been aligned with those zinc rich sources.
Yeah.
And then we'll just look at the why this is important and how zinc, beyond considering measuring it, has real importance in one's cardiovascular health, neurologic health, and in this particular paper, they focus more on metabolic health. And that, as we often comment, is sort of the sweet spot for chronic complex disease these days. So this will be a fun review.
Yeah, no, it's a great topic, Mark, I think for several reasons. First and foremost, I would consider zinc to be probably the most elusive or difficult micronutrient for the majority of people to acquire on a daily basis. Some of that is due to the different forms of zinc and how zinc might be packaged or found in a particular food. You know, so I think it has that as like, you know, the real headline is that zinc absorption can be really difficult for some people, depending on what the food source is, what the overall meal looks like. And then I think also, you know, when you get into zinc, you start to understand a little bit more about the importance for balance in the body, you know, whether that would be, you know, the other nutrients that might be at a meal that can outcompete zinc for absorption sites on the small intestine, other nutrients that zinc has to be kept in balance with. And it's, you know, the way that it's used for enzymes in the liver and for all these different, you know, catalysts, it's just present in so many proteins in the body. And then that gets into the whole Bruce Ames triage theory, where if you don't have enough zinc, your body will try to substitute another mineral, or in this case, a trace mineral. in place of it, but things don't work quite as well as they would if you had the zinc. So I just think zinc is just such a great example of when we get into the nuts and bolts of nutrients and the roles they play in the body and getting them from foods versus getting them from supplements. I think zinc is just such a great example of so many of those topics. It really, you know, serves as a great, you know, just a great learning point for us, myself. I love to go back and look at every year. I'll do it if I'm going to be like teaching a course or I'm going to be, you know, helping out with an organization's curriculum. I love looking at zinc on an annual basis because of some of the papers that are out there that really highlight the gap, as you just spoke to, the gap between dietary recommendations, right, and what papers show to be necessary or important with respect to zinc status in a population, because there's a huge gap, which we'll get into, I'm sure, this morning.
Excellent. I will bring up my slide deck, and I apologize for those listening to this. I'll make sure that these slides and all of the open source references that John and I will be discussing are available on our Health Edge podcast website. And this is the paper, the title of which is Effects of Zinc Supplementation on Glycemic Control, Insulin Resistance, Inflammation, and Oxidative Stress in Diabetes. This is a systematic review and meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials. And I think most evidence-based practitioners would appreciate that a systematic review and meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials is probably the greatest quality of evidence that one can bring to the discussion of benefit. We will look at this paper in detail, but I thought it might be good to just start, John, as we've already set the stage for, with just a kind of a zinc 101 to help people with a broader context before we look at the details of this paper. And as you alluded to, John, zinc is an essential micronutrient that just plays a crucial role in so many biochemical processes, from metabolism, which is the focus of this paper, to protein function, be that a catalyst, an enzyme, lipids, nucleic acids, you know, DNA repair, gene transcription, these epigenetic processes. Zinc plays a central role in all of this. And you'll also see a lot of emphasis of zinc with respect to reproduction, particularly with the higher prevalence of fertility challenges for parents, immune function. The pandemic revealed, and I'll share just a little bit of research on the importance of zinc with COVID and wound healing. Of course, zinc has long been known in the clinical world to assist with wound healing. So you see the cellular effects, tissue and system effects of zinc, and it's indispensable for macrophage, neutrophil, natural killer cell. These are processes that not only help one fight infection, but it's important to remember that our immune system is also a cancer surveillance system. So most people will have evidence of cancer long before a diagnosis, and it is our immune system that will take that rogue cancer cell and vigorously attempt to eliminate it before it can emerge. And so a healthy immune system obviously not only helps with infection management, but with cancer management. I think sometimes that gets lost in the shadow, John. And as we know, this is while it's an abundant element, zinc, we can't store zinc in our bodies, so we require regular dietary intake. This is not something that you can go without and just take from a source in the body, as one might take calcium or phosphorus from the bone. Zinc requires daily intake. And as
that's a huge point, Mark. You know, like people understand that with water soluble vitamins, but I don't feel that we have the same appreciation for that importance when it comes to some of these trace minerals, zinc being, again, like a great example, maybe the best example of that. And the other thing is, Mark, we don't get regular, assessments of a person's zinc status like we do maybe with iron, let's say. Because, you know, iron, you get a whole panel, right? You get hemoglobin, hematocrit. You got all these things that are going to reflect a person's iron status that'll be part of an annual physical that would flag it if there's a deficiency. But I don't feel we get that unless you go to a functional physician and they're measuring, you know, serum zinc or, but that's really rare in comparison to, you know, let's say how iron is looked at. So I think it flies under the radar. I don't mean to get ahead of ourselves here.
No, that's great, John. And as we'll explore more, and this could have been a quote from John Bagnulo, you know, dietary sources include meat, fish, legumes, nuts. You'll find it in plant-based sources, though absorption efficiency varies in many of these sources depending on the food matrix. So as we will look at, and as you will elaborate on, John, while zinc can be found in many food sources, there are some sources where the matrix within which that zinc exists is stingy. It finds it, does not allow absorption to be as complete. And this is very important when we look at nutritional strategies for zinc management. You know, the last measure of this, and I was surprised, I would have thought that it had been something more recent, and maybe I missed it, but the last NHANES data that looked at zinc was in 2018. And as our listeners know, the National Health and Nutrition Exam Survey is a systematic data collection of people who were followed over time. And it's a rich database, not unlike the UK's Biobank. And at this time, based on sort of the standards of what normal levels were, almost 4% of children under the age of 10 were deficient. In adults, about 8 to 9% of males and female adults and teenage kids, older kids, adolescents were deficient. And they found that a lower serum albumin, as we know, zinc is bound to albumin. So if you have a lower albumin, generally through either an acute illness, because zinc will fluctuate with acute stresses in the body, biologic stresses, trauma. And also later in the day, I think this is a whole nother area of laboratory measures, John, that we don't still today don't appreciate that there can be circadian variations in what we will see in the measurement. Because things, particularly depending on one's baseline state of health, their inflammatory burden, their nutritional status, often they exhaust the supplies earlier in the day, and later in the day, if you measure something, it might be lower than if you measure it first thing in the morning. And there are probably many examples of that. But they reiterated that in this data. And these have been the RDIs for zinc now for many years. I'm not aware that there have been any changes.
No.
And, you know, 3 milligrams a day for children under the age of 4, 5 milligrams, 4 to 8, 8 milligrams as you start getting into those growth years, 9 to 13. And then higher levels, 9 milligrams for non-lactating, non-pregnant women. That would be 11 to 12 milligrams a day for pregnant and lactating women, obviously requiring a little bit more, and 11 milligrams a day for men. And as we often talk about, John, and you frequently bring this up, is you have the amounts recommended to prevent a more overt deficiency state, and then you have amounts that are essential for optimal function. And that these conditionally essential, you reference Bruce Ames' work on the triage theory. If you make the case that the overwhelming percentage of kids and adults today are struggling with circadian disruption and new to nature toxins and stressors and changes in our food supply, you could appreciate that as a conditionally essential nutrient in 2026, the metabolic demands for micronutrients like zinc are probably well beyond the RDI recommendations. Is that a fair comment, John?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think that these, for our listeners' sake, these are RDIs. Sometimes, they're referred to as DRIs, but these are much more conservative even than like the RDAs. And they might hold up in a vacuum. To your point, Mark, these might be adequate. I'm going to use the word, it's very conditional, might be adequate if the sources of zinc were highly bioavailable and there was also a concomitant amount of dietary protein to facilitate the body's use and absorption of that zinc. So if there's a certain set of conditions that are met, we could argue that 11 milligrams per day might be enough for an adult. But I think it's very rare that all those conditions are met. And I think that these, again, just looking at the literature over the years, I think that these fall short. And I think that the recommendations could be 25 to 30% higher than they are here. If we really appreciate some of the data, which looks at, to your point, you already started to bring this forward with the NHANES study, a food frequency questionnaire, an attempt to assess zinc status in a population by asking people what they've eaten. It's a good first step, but when all of those things are put kind of in the same basket, meaning that one source of zinc that might be from nuts and seeds or from legumes is considered equal to the zinc found in red meat, that immediately there's a problem with that. And so, yeah. Right. So I think the NHANES study it kind of opens the door and it kind of opens our eyes, I should say, to the prevalence of zinc deficiency. But I think it's much, much worse than even that would appear based on the fact that some of those dietary sources of zinc are given, they're given an equal status as others when it's just not the case. I think it's really difficult to have a highly bioavailable source of zinc from plant foods. I don't think that type of zinc gets absorbed very well. And I think it gives us this kind of false sense of nourishment in a population that's not there.
These are all such important nuances of, a high level look at what a food contains, a measurement in the blood that will reflect more the bioavailability of what that food contains, and then this broader matrix that affects metabolic demand, metabolic need, right? If I drive a Tundra, I might get on a good day 12 miles per gallon. Somebody's driving a Camry and they're getting 28 miles per gallon, and one vehicle has very different metabolic demands right. than another. And if the Camry and the Tundra are driving the same number of miles per week, you're going to see the Tundra at the gas pump much more. You just have greater regular demand because of those demands. And there's so much nuance there, John, that you brought up in your comments. If you now we'll just switch to the paper now with that context, and just by way of summary, this was a study that pooled 18 randomized controlled trials. So RCTs are considered the gold standard of research methodology. This pooling included a total of a little over 1,000 participants that had either type 1 diabetes, type 2 diabetes, certainly the most prevalent, and gestational and pre-diabetes. So all that full sort of spectrum of diabetes and insulin resistance are represented. The average age of folks in these studies was 44 years. And like any pooled analysis, you get variability in And in this case, the intervention, which is zinc as a supplement, was anywhere from 6 weeks on the short end to 1 year on the long end. The average was about 19 weeks, about approximately 4 to 5 months. And the amount of zinc used as an intervention varied from 4 milligrams on the low end to as high as 75 milligrams a day. So while these are powerful methodologies in looking at evidence and how best to translate that evidence, there are inherent variabilities and heterogeneity that do create some things that you have to acknowledge as you draw conclusions from reviews like this. And this is just a brief summary of the conclusions of the study, and I have another graphic that borrowed from Rhonda Patrick. Rhonda Patrick, many people know Rhonda. She's just a terrific clinician, researcher, has a great podcast and a great following. I really like Rhonda's work. But this, so 18 trials, over 1,000 participants. The greatest improvements were seen in measures of insulin resistance. We talk about this a lot, John, as reflected by reductions in insulin itself, as well as the HOMA-IR, which is a measure of insulin resistance as calculated by a morning fasting glucose and a morning fasting insulin level. And the extent to which the pre and post HOMA was down over one point is pretty significant. That got my attention, John.
Oh, yeah.
Didn't see a big difference in lipids. The other two measures, which are so important here, are measures of inflammation and oxidative stress. And we frequently talk about insulin resistance in the context of the effects that it has on inflammation and higher reactive oxygen species, and the extent to which that perfect storm really drives so many chronic complex diseases and quality of life challenges for people. So they saw significant reductions in C-reactive protein. A measure of oxidative stress is the malondialdehyde. Mm-hmm. And they also were able to measure total antioxidant capacity, which went up with the zinc intervention. So metabolic glycemic insulin improvements and improvements systemically with respect to inflammation and measures of oxidative stress.
And that, again, the antioxidant capacity and the reduction in oxidative stress, some of that is tied to the role that zinc plays. And for our listeners, this might help. We have two types of antioxidants in the body. We have the type that we acquire from food, polyphenols, for instance. Again, we can go on and on about all the different antioxidants that are found in food or in coffee or in tea. But you also have this whole other family of antioxidants that are protein-based that the body manufactures. And zinc plays a really, it's a pivotal role in the formation of those. One of those is known as superoxide dismutase, SOD. And superoxide dismutase is one of the most powerful antioxidant enzymes in the body. It's used by the liver to help clean up, lipid peroxides and fatty acids that have become oxidized and that could start to trigger a chain reaction of oxidative stress. It arrests that type of pathway before it gets out of control. And it's we could talk about this over and over about how the body will have to prioritize when you have a limited amount of a particular nutrient. The body has to go into this type of triage and has to use that, in this case, zinc. It has to use what small amounts of zinc might be receiving on a daily basis for some of the more life-sustaining processes in the body. And things like superoxide dismutase, they get cut short and they have, less zinc that is necessary for optimal health. And I think that's really what comes into play here with things like oxidative stress and antioxidant capacity in the body. If we have suboptimal levels of zinc, our immune system is probably going to have priority over the access to that, right? In comparison to a detoxification pathway. So it's fascinating, but I love that paper, Mark, and the fact that you have a huge range, 4 to 75, both are pretty extreme. 4 milligrams is pretty low. You know, most zinc supplementation interventions are going to be somewhere around 10, and the high end is going to be around 25. So you got 4 to 75. It gives us a really big spectrum here to look at, which I think is pretty cool with this.
Great points. And this is just another graphic depicting these findings. And anything in this sort of pinkish column here would be considered improvements.
Yeah, it's awesome.
And
look at
that. Again, you get improvements in insulin, you get HOMA-IR, as we talked about, modest reductions in fasting glucose, and again, these measures of antioxidant capacity and inflammation. And here again, the only intervention was zinc.
Right.
All of this, I think, it does beg for the question, John, beyond the average person who may not be getting adequate and bioavailable zinc in their diets. And we talk all the time about our food supply today and the depletion in our soil of these critical nutrients, many things that we know can interfere with the bioavailability. But there are chronic conditions that people can have, even with a well-balanced nutritional program, that can leave them at risk. And so we know that as people get older, you know, their absorption capacity is reduced. Often, you know, they're just not as nourished, maybe not eating enough of nutrient-dense foods. I see a lot of older adults, so less so now that I'm retired, John, but I think one of the hidden epidemics in our society are the elderly, many of whom are sort of shut in, they're mm-hmm. socially isolated, they have social determinants of health that make it hard for them to buy quality foods or prepare those foods. And so there is this sort of silent epidemic of people out there that are just struggling to get by. And that's an important area of emphasis in any public health or population health model of care. A lot of people we know, John, take acid suppression.
Yeah,
particularly,
that's a big one.
Proton pump inhibitors, they're so effective for reflux that a medication that was initially approved for 4 to 8 weeks for ulcers or reflux is now something people take for a lifetime. And we know that acid is an important aspect of bioavailability, from the protein we eat to the nutrients that those foods contain. And so one can see insufficient bioavailability, not just zinc, but magnesium, vitamin B12. That's a whole nother topic. You talk about this often, John. We're in this sort of culture now where the mantra is plant-based, and we know that zinc content is often significantly less bioavailable because of these phytates and things that bind it. And that's a huge issue, particularly for vegans and vegetarians, many of whom will have zinc deficiency states much greater than the general population. Yeah. And then, of course, chronic gastrointestinal issues. Zinc is mostly absorbed in the small intestine. And so people dealing with celiac disease, Crohn's, you know, after bariatric surgery, frequently will have absorptive challenges that require regular measurement and supplementation to assure adequate bioavailability of these critical micronutrients. And we know that women who are pregnant and nursing certainly will have higher need based on just feeding two people instead of one, and the many metabolic demands that poses. And I'll let you run with this, John. These are sort of the common dietary sources of zinc and their average zinc content. And again, I know you'll look at more than just the amount contained as opposed to the amount ultimately absorbed, John. But how, run with this.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I guess where I'd start is I'd say, if you look at zinc absorption, it's not we're not very efficient at absorbing zinc, even when it's from the best possible sources, meaning that there's no phytic acid or phytates present. You've got some sort of animal protein present. Those are the, kind of the better case scenarios. No phytates, not a massive amount of calcium in the way of like an antacid or a supplement. And you have an animal protein present. Those things are going to really be huge determinants in how well we absorb zinc or its overall bioavailability. So that 30% might be as good as it gets. And then it gets down to almost zero mark when we have, like, I see cereals on here. Cereals, or you might sometimes see certain legumes are great sources, or wheat germ. I laugh whenever I see that wheat germ is a great source of zinc, because there are substances in wheat germ, navy beans, as well as nuts and seeds, even things like almonds. You just don't absorb that zinc unless you take some type of real extraneous measure to soak, ferment certain foods. So you break down the phytates. Maybe you combine those foods with an acid as well. If you take that type of effort, you can take certain plant foods and you can make them much more bioavailable. And then you might get in the 25% absorption rate. I say might because it, like you mentioned earlier with the analogy of the Tundra and the Toyota Camry, right? Or Corolla, whatever more fuel efficient vehicle it was. Some individuals are going to be better, and that might be a function of their small intestinal environment, their microbiome. There's a lot of different facets to this. But when I look at this list, Mark, oysters are without question the best source of zinc on the planet. Six medium oysters are going to give you about 75 milligrams of zinc. So six medium oysters can be 75 milligrams of zinc. That's unheard of. Mm. And then after that, it's red meat. And red meat might, depending on the cut of meat, give you anywhere from the, 5 milligrams here to 7 or 8 milligrams. But shellfish in general are excellent. Shellfish being, crab, lobster, not just oysters, but oysters are the best. You get into mussels, clams, scallops, all of those bivalves are really high in zinc, and it's all incredibly bioavailable. There's nothing there that's going to inhibit absorption. But when you're in the area of shellfish and meat, everything that's present enhances the zinc absorption. So you're going to get to that 30, maybe 35%. Range of absorption. But then when you get into the nuts and seeds, I think that this is really misleading. I think so many people, would look at a plant-based diet and would say, yeah, I think I'm getting all the zinc I need while I eat these foods. But again, the bioavailability is so low that they don't really contribute. The milk product one is fascinating, because milk, which is rich in calcium and rich in casein, it has a lower bioavailability than, let's say, meat or fish or shellfish, because of the casein and the calcium. So if you're drinking milk, you are going to absorb some of the zinc. If you're eating cottage cheese or yogurt, you're going to absorb some of the zinc. It's not as bad. There's no phytates there, so it's not as bad as it would be from like grains or legumes. But it isn't as good as it is from meat or shellfish. However, this is what's fascinating about the zinc story. If you were to put milk, yogurt, or some type of cheese with a moderate zinc content or a moderate zinc contribution, if you were to put that with, let's say, a food that is rich in phytates, it actually helps enhance the zinc absorption from that phytate-containing food. So again, there's just just that food matrix topic that we love to talk about. It's hard to, you know, to really, I think for most people to appreciate how dairy products can really change the absorption of something in the case of zinc. So, but that list is, I think, it's just the content of a food. It doesn't really speak to the bioavailability, which you and I are really trying to illuminate here. I would say that for our listeners' sake, your four best sources are going to be shellfish, red meat, and then fish, and then after fish, poultry, but poultry to a much lesser extent than the others. Sardines and mackerel are very high in zinc compared to maybe some whitefish and things like that. But this is an example of where red meat on a consistent basis is one of the most nourishing foods we can eat.
Yeah.
Probably leave it at that, yeah.
Great.
And by the time you get to these, you're going to speak to this. By the time you get to these states, right? I think our listeners need to understand this, is that by the time you get to one of these particular conditions, you're looking at anywhere from 2 to 6 months of zinc deficiency.
Yeah, I've got, for those who can't see the slide that I just put up, these are common symptoms of zinc deficiency. And to your point, John, once any individual starts manifesting signs and symptoms of a micronutrient deficiency, their total body amount is probably very, very depleted. And so we know that common symptoms, you see people, and I can tell you a lot of physicians wouldn't immediately think of zinc if you go to your doctor today and say that, you know, your taste isn't what it once was, they're going to think COVID more than anything. We know that many mental health, behavioral health issues, from depression to ADHD, anxiety, very much linked to zinc deficiency. And in a moment, we'll talk about the importance of copper zinc as a dyad, this ratio, very important in mental health, brain health, immunity. I think people can appreciate the importance of that now. Wound healing, we've talked about. And, you know, chronic zinc deficiency will certainly perpetuate diarrhea, hair loss, problems with wound healing. And so, yeah, you do not want to get to this point. But these are...
And testosterone levels, Mark. I mean, testosterone levels really suffer with not a zinc deficiency, even suboptimal intake.
Yes.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, and that's so important when one looks at zinc in the context of fertility. And so, yeah, you can appreciate how widespread these manifestations can be. And they're also very nonspecific. There were certainly, the pandemic, I think, revealed the importance between zinc levels at clinical admission and outcomes. And if you looked at any individual admitted to an acute care environment from COVID, those with lower zinc levels tended to have much worse outcomes. And zinc, in that example, where you've got this very high oxidative inflammatory burden, an immune system overwhelmed, you can appreciate that the reserve that allows one to begin to navigate those metabolic demands becomes critical. And even with this, in my experience, John, zinc often not routinely measured in individuals with more severe COVID manifestations. I saw a lot of these folks, and zinc deficiency was not unusual. And if you're not thinking about it, you'll never pick it up. And there's so much that we don't know about the, if you're zinc deficient with an acute infection like COVID or maybe influenza, might your, not only your outcomes be worse in terms of survival, length of stay in a hospital, recovery time, but, might your predilection toward what we might call a long hauler COVID, more of a chronic, much in the same way that we might see with Lyme or Epstein-Barr, for reasons we don't understand. Some people never fully recover from those initial insults, and one can only imagine to what extent micronutrient deficiencies may contribute to that. And this is a good segue, John, to look at this serum copper to zinc ratio. And this was a recent study looking at the serum copper to zinc ratio and the risk of incident infection in men. And this is a study that the ischemic heart disease risk factor study. And this was published in the European Journal of Epidemiology. And they looked at these ratios and how they correlated with cardiovascular outcomes. And there were very significant increases in cardiovascular risk as measured by heart attacks, both fatal, non-fatal heart attacks, congestive heart failure. These are frequent and common cardiovascular outcomes that are measured in these studies. And what they showed was that a high copper to zinc ratio, especially a serum copper concentration, were associated with increased risk of incident infections and cardiovascular outcomes, adverse outcomes in older men. This was a study from Finland.
Yeah, and the mechanism there, Mark, and I don't mean to interrupt, but the mechanism is, you know, probably angiogenesis when it comes to heart disease, because, you know, copper tends to promote angiogenesis and is associated with a higher level of oxidative stress, whereas zinc inhibits angiogenesis. And, you know, angiogenesis is an important process for the body for healing and things like that. But we know that when it's accelerated, it kind of lends itself to heart disease and cancer. And I think we've talked about William Lee's research in Boston. And he's just, you know, one of the foremost experts on angiogenesis and how it relates to different diseases. And, you know, the copper-zinc ratio is a huge determinant in that, as it is for things like blood-brain barrier, permeability, and the list goes on and on. So it's a huge, this is a huge area of epidemiology that's kind of really gained a lot of momentum in the last 10 years or so. And I think, again, it speaks to some of the issues that arise when people say, well, I'm just going to eat plants. If you're just going to eat plants, you're going to get a lot of copper at the end of the day, and you're not going to get very much zinc. Probably like a high level summary here on an issue that I have seen in a lot of people I've worked with. You know, avocados, great food. And you and I talk about how wonderful avocados are and part of a low carb diet, and they're really a healthy fat. They're great. But very high in copper. Nuts and seeds, it's the same thing. Whether you're talking about pecans, almonds, you name it, right? They're high in copper, and the zinc is very low in terms of its bioavailability. Chocolate, great things we can say about dark chocolate, but it is loaded with copper. Doesn't really give us any zinc. So at the end of the day, those are just three foods or groups of foods. You start getting into other foods that have copper as well, and you can see where someone might be following this plant-based diet and it's rich in all these different superfoods, right? And next thing you know, it's like they've got a 3-to-1 ratio of copper to zinc, and things aren't going in the direction that they wished or hoped for when they started following this plant-based diet for health reasons.
Yeah, these are such important points, and quite frankly, not something that I've looked closely at through the years. John, this is an eye-opener for me. Copper and zinc are so linked. They have many synergistic effects, yet they compete for absorption.
Yeah.
So to the points that you were just making, John, and many people suggest that the balance of copper and zinc has much more clinical implication and significance than looking at either nutrient alone. You know, a healthy ratio generally would range from about one part copper to 8 to 10 parts zinc. So you can appreciate that getting more copper while becoming more deficient in zinc can very significantly alter those ratios. Yeah. And you touched on this, John. High ratios, excess copper, or low zinc, or a combination, is frequently linked to systemic inflammation, oxidative stress, infection, as this last study looked at, chronic illness, and also in relation to cardiovascular conditions, neurologic conditions, certain cancers. You really start to see this sort of chronic complex disease in a more generalized way being driven by alterations in these ratios, much the same way, though I think there's much less, you don't see a lot of research in this area, but a low ratio generally would indicate copper deficiency. And that is important from hematologic, red cell production, iron metabolism, nervous system function. So, you know, if I were, if somebody said, Mark, geez, what would you do differently today than maybe 5, 10+ years ago? I would definitely be measuring copper with zinc in a more routine manner. Again, just a few other papers to round out this discussion, John, that support some of the findings in this meta analysis that we looked at. And this was another systematic review published in 2025. So I was very intrigued by two pretty good reviews, similar methodologies. This was also zinc and type 2 diabetes, systematic review. Again, very consistent with what the other review found, that zinc is mechanistically involved in insulin synthesis, antioxidant defense. And to your point, John, zinc itself isn't an antioxidant, as you would see with, say, glutathione or vitamin C. It supports the metabolic systems that allow more systemic antioxidant defense and inflammatory control. You know, clinical evidence hasn't adopted zinc as a routine therapeutic agent, but one definitely wants to be more mindful of assessing zinc status in any individual for that matter, but certainly those with insulin resistance or higher inflammatory burden. This is, I think, a very important part of personalized nutrition. This paper nicely summarized the many mechanisms and reasons why zinc is so critical. And again, another study, this was from Iran. You don't see a lot of research in the mainstream literature, at least I haven't, out of Iran. So this is very recent. This was in BMC Cardiovascular 2026. And
it's fascinating.
These are zinc deficiencies in patients with type 2 diabetes, increased risk from cardiovascular disease, the Tehran lipid and glucose study. And so what did they find? Zinc deficiency is associated with a significantly increased risk of cardiovascular disease events in individuals with type 2 diabetes. Increased serum zinc concentration was associated with reduced risk of cardiovascular disease events in patients with type 2 diabetes. So we've got a few recent studies here, John, that align with what this review showed and what we're sharing. This might be the last paper that I have here, but also from the Middle East. This is from Qatar, a cross-sectional analysis of zinc and copper levels and their relationship to cardiovascular disease. And again, very similar. They found that the copper-zinc ratio was a very important predictor of cardiovascular disease risk. And again, having a higher zinc to copper ratio or a lower copper to zinc ratio, depending on how you're looking at that, was very protective against cardiovascular disease. They also found that higher copper levels, as we've talked about here, are linked to obesity, poor glycemic control, and cardiovascular risk. So maintaining these optimal levels and balance seems a really important opportunity. And so that, you know, by way of summary, John, it's quite clear that zinc has a myriad of important biological effects in humans. Because we don't store it, we need regular maintained intake of zinc. It plays such an important balance as a micronutrient in all chronic complex diseases. But I think if you look at insulin resistance, inflammation as metabolic drivers of many chronic complex diseases today, you'd have to put this very high on the list of micronutrients to be thinking about and concerned about. And then lastly, John, you know, just because a food is higher in zinc doesn't mean you're going to get the zinc that you're ingesting. Yeah. And so that bioavailability conversation is so important. And these are things that you can measure. Zinc and copper can be measured. I can't imagine a scenario where any insurer wouldn't cover that. These are not expensive tests. And I think for you, the individual, who probably now knows more about this than your practitioner, you know, this is a really important thing to have in your portfolio, your metabolic portfolio, and something you can do something about and track over time.
Yeah. And then, you know, the anthropological record would suggest this was the first micronutrient that when you look at the fossil records of early human civilization, as those different areas went to a more agricultural or grain-based diet, this is what showed up as the most prevalent deficiency that many anthropologists agree upon was associated with a reduction in the overall health of those populations, whether it be more infectious disease. And again, the fossil record really can help them connect the dots in ways that I think a lot of us don't appreciate. But zinc deficiencies became rampant when our ancestors switched from the hunter-gatherer way of life, and with the advent of agriculture, a more cereal or grain-based diet. And I think some of that persists today. And the last thing I'll say, Mark, is that if you don't have a record from your annual physicals for our listeners' sake, but you see that you have abnormal white blood cell populations, that's something I've seen a lot of the clients that I work with, is that we suspect a zinc deficiency based on maybe some of their symptoms, or I do based on how they're eating. I see there's just not a lot of bioavailable zinc present on a daily basis, but we see that they have, again, low neutrophil, low lymphocyte counts. Those are red flags in many cases for a micronutrient, especially zinc. So yeah, just something to add in that list of conditions that can arise, and low white blood cell counts in particular populations are often the first indication that many people get. And I don't know how many physicians would see that and would flag that or would say, we should do some follow-up here. You've got a very low lymphocyte count.
Yeah, great points to conclude on, John. I think a lot of this is not on the radar, right, in my experience, in the traditional primary care environment, even in the subspecialty environment. So yeah, this I think is underrecognized. So some great news to use. We appreciate people listening to the Health Edge. I'll make sure these papers that we referenced and the slide deck are available on our website, healthedgepodcast.com. And John, as the month of August slowly winds down, I hope you have some fun coming up, and I look forward to connecting next week if you're available. And peace, brother.
Same here, brother. Love you.
Love you too.